Good afternoon. So last time we talked about a bunch of scheduling algorithms. We had first come, first served, sometimes also known as FIFO, which is we just take the programs in the order they become ready to run and run them. We talked about round robin, which we learned was the name for the scheduling policy that XV6 has, where we choose a time quantum. In the case of XV6, they don't like explicitly choose an amount of time, but they have a timer interrupt happen every so often, and we run for that amount of time, and then switch to the next thing in the list, or of course, if the program can't keep using the CPU, we switch to the next thing in the list when it gives up the CPU, for example, to wait for some IO event. And we looked at, well, if we have to choose this time quantum, like, what does that choice mean? And we learned that, well, a shorter time quantum meant we lowered our throughput, which was bad, and we got better fairness, which was probably good. And so we have this trade-off where it's not obvious, you know, what that should be set to, and it's kind of about managing, you know, how much throughput do we want, how much fairness do we want. Then we talked about priority scheduling. So we talked about these other sort of two very different scheduling algorithms. So priority scheduling is just that we specify a priority for a program when we run the more important program preferentially to the less important programs. And there's a lot of different ways we can set those priorities. So we can actually use priority scheduling to implement a whole lot of scheduling policies. And we're seeing that with what we left off with last time with this shortest first scheduling policy, which is priority scheduling, where we set the priorities based on how long things are expected to run. We also talked about proportional share or lottery scheduling, where with lottery scheduling, we have this weighted random choice. And this was another thing where we could implement a lot of different policies by setting these weights. And unlike priority scheduling, where, you know, basically, you know, we were starting with something which was extremely unfair, here we're kind of starting with something that's, in a certain sense, very fair and making it less fair to achieve our other scheduling goals. So after looking at those two scheduling policies, we went back to our original scheduling metrics and we had looked at throughput and fairness, but we talked about turnaround time, but we didn't actually have a good solution for how can we optimize turnaround time. And we figured out that the big thing that was a problem with turnaround time is that we have programs which wanted to do a little bit of work on the CPU, which would wait behind programs which wanted to do a lot of work on the CPU. And we could have a whole bunch of those programs that wanted to do a little bit of work wait behind one long program. And that caused really high turnaround times. So the way to avoid that is to run the things that only want to use a little bit of CPU first. And that gives us this shortest job first scheduling policy. And when we left off last time, we mentioned that, well, we need to deal with preemption in that. So I showed you the version of the policy without preemption. We learned, well, preemption's going to be really important because if we have something long running and as that's happening, a program that just wants to run for a little bit of time becomes available, intuitively, we actually want to interrupt the long running program so we don't have it wait, have a really long turnaround time. But there's some details we need to work out about exactly how we do that, which is what we'll get to next. But before I do that, questions on these things we covered last time? Okay. So I'll pick up on, we had this diagram. So we said, here we're doing non-preemptive, so we aren't interrupting programs while they're running. shortest job first. So, for example, you know, right here we have our program B becomes ready and program C become ready, and we run them program B first because it's shorter. And this is kind of trying to achieve that goal of minimizing turnaround time, but we have this kind of awkwardness that we still have this convoy effect. So what it seems like we should do is we should just say, rather than delaying program B and C, we should just like run, in this case, we have program B right away here, and we should run program C right away here to avoid that long turnaround time. And so the intuition is that this is that what we want to actually do is preemptive priority scheduling, where our priorities are that B has the highest priority, then C, then A. But if we do that, we are going to run into this problem. And that's that there's a little bit of a corner case we need to think about. And that's, what if our long job is almost done running? So the scenario we're thinking of is that, you know, we had our A, and, you know, this is how it would run alone, and we had something interrupt it, like, right here. And if we were to do the thing of just prioritizing, you know, the thing that interrupted it to go right there, we might run into this scenario where we have this sort of long job waiting on this this medium job here, and we'd end up having a higher mean turnaround time, because although we minimize C's turnaround time, we've increased A's turnaround time by a bunch. You know, we've increased A's turnaround time by this much when the cost of not running C was that if we just decided to wait to run C, we would have increased C's turnaround time by a smaller amount. So in terms of optimizing total turnaround time, which is, you know, lower when mean turnaround time is lower, you know, we haven't actually done the right thing by letting the shorter program run immediately. Now, this is only the case because the shorter program, you know, interrupted A when A was almost done. And this is going to give us our fix for this, which is that we don't want to look at how long A takes overall, but we want to look at A's remaining time. So our solution is that our priority should be approximately equal to the remaining time. And this gives a scheduler that's often called shortest remaining time first. So we're going to prioritize by what they have left to do. And by doing that, we're going to avoid this issue of what if the short job finishes just before the long one is done, or so becomes ready just before the long one is done. We're going to realize, wait a moment, if you only have a little bit left to do, we're going to let you finish that rather than pausing you. But this means that this is more complicated to implement, of course, because we need to now not estimate sort of the overall time, but the actual time that's left, which is going to change all the time. So if we look at that, we can apply this preemptive schedule, and we get something like this example. So here we have, say, B runs, then C, then A, and that's sort of our normal ordering for run the shortest thing first. Because when nothing has done anything, the remaining time and the total time are the same. But then something changes here. So here we're doing our preemption. And in this case, the remaining time of B is its total time until it's going to do its next IO, which is that amount of time. And the remaining time for A is this amount of time, which is slightly bigger. So B does actually run before A in this case, because we realized, oh, A has more work to do than B does, even though A has already done a bunch of work just now. But in this case, when C interrupts A during that extra work, well, the amount of time that A has left, this little box here, is much less than the amount of time C has left. So A keeps running, even though A is longer in general. Right now, it doesn't have very much to do before it's ready to give up the CPU. And we just apply that every time something becomes runnable, we make that comparison. So questions about this scheduling policy and how it works in this timeline here. So the question is, what does the processor do if there's nothing to run? So for example, in the schedule here, I have some amount of time when everything is waiting for some I/O to complete. So in this case, typically the OS will have some OS written program that runs just to tell the CPU to not do anything. In XV6, what happens here is that the scheduler runs an infinite loop where it keeps checking to see if the process table has changed. But you might imagine a better OS would do something that might like save power here. Other questions? So question is, how are we estimating how long the program will run? We will get to that question in a bit, but it's a very good one because obviously we can't always do that. Okay, I gave you us two scheduling algorithms. So I gave you the non-preemptive version and the preemptive version. I'm going to call the preemptive version SRTF and the non-preemptive version SJF, but things you read might use different names. They might call both of them SJF and just say SJF with preemption or without. But this preemptive scheduler minimizes mean turnaround time, mean/total turnaround time. If you ignore context switching clause, it does context switch more often than you might need to, and that context switch, of course, is not actually free. But if you ignore the context switch clause, you can prove, we're not going to do the proof, but you can prove that it will minimize mean turnaround time. And if you disallow preemption or leaving the CPU deliberately idle, the non-preemptive version also minimizes mean turnaround time with respect to all non-preemptive schedulers because we're disallowing preemption. And what I mean by leaving the CPU deliberately idle is that if we imagine this schedule here, it would have been better if we can't do preemption, if we can't take the CPU away from a program we've started to not let A run here, so we could wait for B to finish. But if you ignore schedules where we don't run things that don't run anything when we could run something, then SJF is optimal for avoiding preemption for turnaround time. So questions on these ideas of what these are optimal for? So I'd say, okay, so we know these are optimal, but let's get to that question. Like, how do we estimate how long the program will use the CPU? And it's hard. So sometimes you could ask. So for example, in a batch job scheduling system, so in something like a supercomputer where people run programs that take many hours to run, people just often ask for that number. But you know, that doesn't really work for our context. And you might say, well, maybe we could kind of guess from one of these, but there's not really any obvious sort of correlation between like the amount of memory the program has allocated, what files it has opened that are actually going to tell us what that length is. We could kind of guess. But the way we're going to guess, actually, is that none of this information is really helpful for guessing. So what is the question. So we're going to use heuristics, and the key heuristic, by heuristic I mean something which often works but doesn't always, is that we're going to say that CPU bursts now are going to be like ones later. So the way we're going to figure out how long the program will take to use the CPU is we're going to examine how long it took before. And we're going to assume it's roughly the same. Is this going to be accurate? Sometimes. Actually, a lot of the time. Because a program that's like getting keyboard input, probably still getting keyboard input. A program that's doing a lot of computation, probably does a lot of computation for a while. So a lot of the time, this is pretty good. But obviously, a program doesn't have to work this way. It could like do lots of little bits of CPU and then a really long one and then lots of little bits or of one little bit and then a long one. It could be written in a way which breaks this, but most of the time this works, and this is going to be our scheme for making this estimate. So we're just going to observe what the program did before and assume that what it's going to do next after it wakes up from the next I/O, for example, is roughly the same. The question, so with regards to asking about runtime, would that be something like Slurm? So Slurm is a batch job scheduling system that the department happens to use. It says where the user says this should take no more than X hours. So yes, that would be an example of getting sort of an estimate that may or may not be accurate of the CPU burst length in that batch job context. But unfortunately, when we're writing desktop programs, there's no sort of equivalent of that. And it would be hard to imagine that if we asked for that, that we get accurate numbers. Because we need to have some incentive for users to give a correct number. In the case of these batch job scheduling systems, there's some incentive for users to give an accurate number, because if they give a wrong number that's too low, their jobs probably get killed for running too long. And if they give a long number that's too high, their jobs don't get to run. But that's not something we're really willing to do for desktop applications. We're not willing to say, if you estimate wrong how much CPU time you need, we're going to make your program break. It's not acceptable. And because of that, we don't really have that sort of estimate and shouldn't expect to get one. So instead, we're going to rely on techniques like these. So let's look at one way of, you know, applying this intuition here that has been commonly used in schedulers, which is a design for a scheduler known as multi-level feedback queues. So this is a strategy for imitating SRTF based on, you know, to approximate SRTF based on priority schedule. So our intuition is that, well, if our priority is our current estimate of how long things should run, well, that's what we're going to do. We're just going to set the priority to track our estimate for how long is this program going to use the CPU. And then the question is just how do we update the priorities? And we're going to update the priorities based on how long the programs actually use the CPU. And to make that work, we're going to do something where we're going to adjust the time quantums for each of the priorities. So we're going to say that, hey, if you're at the highest priority, that means you don't use the CPU for very long. So we'll set your time quantum to a small number. And if you're at a lower priority, we'll set it to a high number. And we're going to sort of have a target range for how long you should use the CPU, sort of, you know, programs, you know, expected CPU burst length. And if we see that you run for more than a millisecond at priority 3, we're going to say you shouldn't be here. and we're going to change your priority to priority 2 or 1 or 0. And if you say are at priority 0 and you use less than a millisecond before giving up the CPU, we're going to say you shouldn't be there. We're going to move you up to the next priority. And that's how we're going to make adjustments. And the, you know, common implementation of this is that we'll set a time quantum that we'll run you with, and this is sort of the time quantum for a round robin scheduler. Differently at each priority. And our scheduling algorithm will be that we'll run the highest priority thing that's runnable for the time quantum based on its priority. So we'll let it run only as long as, you know, this time quantum. And if it uses the whole time slice, so if it uses all this 10 milliseconds, then we'll move it down to the next. So this is another word for time quantum. We'll move it down to the next priority and then run the next thing by using our original policy of run the highest priority thing, which will, in this case, would now be thread B. If it finishes early, so if it doesn't use the whole time slice, we'll say, oh, maybe it was less than a millisecond. We don't actually typically bother timing it. We're just going to say, okay, let's move it up to priority 3. And a question is, if it uses the whole slice, does it get stopped? Yes. So if thread A, say, wanted to have a 100 millisecond CPU burst, what's going to happen here is we're going to run the first 10 milliseconds of that and then shift and then stop thread A, set it to priority 1, and run thread B instead. And this way, if a program suddenly changes behavior, if it suddenly switches from doing short CPU bursts to really long ones, we're not going to do anything really bad about like running something really long that's going to delay other programs, because, you know, once it's obvious that the program's running for really long, we'll stop that. So the question is, where does this algorithm run? So this would be in the scheduler. So in XV6, if you implemented this, that scheduler loop I showed you that ran on each core would have all this logic in it. And we'd probably need some other stuff to implement these time quantums accurately. XV6 doesn't really track the time very precisely, but we need to add some code to do that. And quite another question is, would a more complex scheduling algorithm use more CPU? Yes. And this scheduling algorithm is kind of designed to be pretty simple as far as CPU usage. And maybe that's not so obvious, but one reason why is that we can implement the run the highest priority process. This can be like something like a heap or binary tree lookup. So this can be a sort of login operation, and if we have a binary tree or heap, each of these sort of insertions and updates to that can be, you know, some log n sort of thing. So it's actually not that inefficient. Yes, it's a whole lot more code, but, you know, we're running programs for generally at least a millisecond, so as long as it's, you know, in this sort of microseconds range, it's probably not significant. But part of the design of this algorithm versus other ideas we might have, where maybe we like try to get an exact number for the CPU burst length of each program, part of the reason that this idea that people actually use doesn't do that is that it's simpler than some of those other ideas might be, and therefore lower overhead. Other questions? So a question is, with the policy I have here, let's say A runs for 5 milliseconds every time. What's going to happen is that A is going to end up going up to priority 1, then back down, then back up. And, you know, question is, would we really do that? And there are sort of two... So, with the policy I've written down, yes, that's what would happen. We'd have it oscillate between the two priorities. We could hypothetically avoid that if, like, maybe we had, like, three options here, you know, finished early but not too early as sort of a early put at same priority next time. And this might be something real implementations might have those three options. I just drew the version with only two options to make it simpler. Because the two options are enough to make this policy work. Other questions? Write this out. Okay. So what would we would expect to happen with the sort of original version of our policy is that, you know, if a thread always uses the same CPU burst length, it always ends up at the right priority. With the design I've shown you there, sort of it goes, oscillates back and forth, but it's always at about the right place. And in a real implementation of this, we might have, like, you know, maybe not four priority levels, but like 50 or 100. And that would make that oscillation not be a significant sort of issue as far as weird performance. So it just always ends up at the right priority. So to give an example of how this might work and also go over some tricky issues with it. So here, let's say I have three priorities and I've drawn the quantum, the amount of time we want to run things, here. And here I have A and B, and they initially start at the highest priority, which is what we probably do if we had a new program. If we don't know where it should be, we'll start at the highest priority because we'll quickly learn if its CPU bursts are too long. So what happens here is B gets to run for this, this time quantum, and then gets demoted. And when by the time B gets demoted, A is ready to run, so we run A immediately, which is good, because A, in fact, is supposed to be at this highest priority because it has a short CPU burst. And so B gets to wait, and then B gets to run until it uses its time quantum. And note that something that happens here, and something that's a little bit of a bookkeeping annoyance to implement this well, is that because A got to run in the middle of B, we had to use that time quantum in two parts, and we had to, like, track that appropriately. Because, as we would expect, A got to run while B was running, because A should have, you know, higher priority being a shorter job. And we can see this oscillation behavior here with the policy I've shown, where B, you know, it uses too much time for priority 2, but when it's at priority 1, it doesn't use its whole quantum, so it gets promoted back up. So a question is, if we have a lot of priority 3 things, wouldn't the context switching cause a lot of overhead? Yes. And this is us making a trade-off in choosing to try to optimize mean turnaround time, that we're going to hurt our throughput by doing that. And we kind of have to do that because if we want to prioritize things which are responding to I/O, you know, that's going to mean more context switches, just how it is. Other questions? So, question is, isn't B stopped in priority 2 or just moved? I'm not sure what you're referring to. But here, B, after it uses its time quantum in priority 3, gets moved to priority 2. Then, while it's running in priority 2, it gets interrupted by A, which doesn't contribute to the time quantum we measure. And then, after it uses that entire time quantum in these two pieces, it gets moved to priority 3. And then it gets moved up to priority 2, but it's not runnable until after its I.O. finishes. But it's, we remember that it goes to priority 2 when it does get to run, you know, after it actually finishes. And question is this be ready section kind of sort of time quantum? No. So the time quantum for B here is these two pieces is equal to, that's where we count the time quantum. Because we don't want to, you know, change our measurement for B based on how much other stuff is going on at higher priorities. And, or another way of thinking about it is we're trying to estimate the remaining time for B, which is the amount, which is, you know, this plus this. It doesn't include the time other stuff gets to run. Because if we were running B alone, we'd expect it to take this plus this amount of time. Other questions, comments? So the question is, why does it go down to priority 1 and then back to 2? So when it goes down to priority 1, what happened is we used the whole time slice. It, because priority 1 had a certain amount of time it was allocated, and thread B used all of that time running on the CPU, so it goes down to the lower priority. And then when it was at priority 1, after that, this happened. It finished before using all the time it was allowed to use at priority 1. So we remembered that next time it was runnable, we want to run it at a higher priority. Does that answer question? Other questions? So in this design, anything that isn't super fast will switch between two priorities. Anything that isn't super fast or super slow, something super slow will stay at priority 1, or the lowest possible priority. Yes. As I mentioned earlier, that we could avoid that by adding sort of an extra option here that keeps things at the same priority. I just didn't do that because I wanted to make this simpler as far as what our choices were. Other questions, comments? Oh, and question, does A not move since there's no priority 4? Yes. So if there were a higher priority, we, with the policy I showed you, A would go to that priority. But since there's no higher priority, if we try to move it to a higher priority, we just do nothing. That's a good question. Other questions? Okay. So this is a pretty reasonably efficient way of approximating shortest remaining time first, where, you know, we have to do some extra work of making sure we enforce how long we let things run, and also figuring out whether things, you know, ran for too long or gave up the CPU for some other reason. But otherwise, this is not actually much more complicated than implementing a normal priority scheduler, so it's pretty efficient. Now, there's some problems with this, and that we can kind of cheat. So, for example, let's say I have a program which, by all rights, should be running at priority one. It just does a huge computation, it doesn't do any I.O., and, you know, it's not something interactive, and if we want to let the things that are, like, getting keyboard input run, it shouldn't get priority. I can rewrite my program by doing my work in these little chunks and then giving up the CPU in some deliberate way, so I always use a little less than the time quantum ideally for pure. So, like, I just make sure my program looks like use that much time, do something very short, use that much time, do something very short, and so on. So I just structure my program like that. So just adding extra I/O or similar operations to my program, and suddenly I'm at the highest priority all the time. So this is kind of something which is not great about this. If you think about things people might do in their programs on a multi-user system to get more CPU time, or things people might do by accident when they're, you know, measuring the performance of their program as they make optimizations, they might realize, oh, suddenly it's faster. Don't know why. Okay. So it's a thing that's not so great about multi-level feedback use. And there's another fairness issue. So here I have a hypothetical scenario. Let's say we're using multi-level feedback queues, and I have a program A, which is doing my long computation, a bunch of programs that are processing data on disk, 1,000 of them, and an interactive program. So about how much time do we expect A to get in this scenario if we have a multi-level feedback queue as our scheduler? So we're trying to, like, make this interactive program run well. Like, that's the big goal we have. Give another 10 seconds. Okay, so have a spectrum of answers. So I think the best answer is essentially none. So this is a case where we'll have that starvation we talked about earlier. And the reason why is that if we think of programs processing data on disk, they're going to, you know, data processing and then read disk or write disk, data processing. So they're going to, this is going to be their CPU bursts. And their CPU bursts are going to be shorter than A, which is just one long CPU burst. And this means they're assuming that this amount of time, the amount of time between we process data between reading the disk, is short enough that it fits in one of those higher priority time quantums, the B program should have higher priority than A. And if there are enough of the B programs to use all the available CPU time, the A program literally won't run. And I think that would be the most likely outcome here. Questions, comments about my reasoning? So the question is, would a lottery sort of scheduler implementation solve this? So we could. So one idea we might have for solving this, and a common thing that actually real SRTF programs do is that, well, not something that real they do, but one idea we might have is that, yeah, we could have, like, make a weighted random choice instead of doing strict priority. So that would solve this. A more common solution to this problem is that if a program doesn't get to run for a long time, we might just deliberately run it, which is what most multi-level feedback queue implementations that care about this problem do, is that they just track that, oh, A hasn't run for, 10 minutes, let's actually run it. Question is, couldn't these programs be, these B programs finish at some point and then A could run? Yes. So if these programs actually finished, yes, then we'd expect A to run eventually. It would be hard to come up with a percentage, though, for how A would get to run. If you were thinking about them terminating. Other questions, comments? Okay. So, since I've shown you that, so the question is, every program needs fake I/O to survive. So the real world solution is sometimes increase priority. The most common one. This is not the only one. So common real world solution for programs that haven't run in a while. So yeah. So something that real operating systems that use a scheduler like this will do is that they'll track if a program hasn't run for a long time and increase its priority, despite that violating the sort of feedback queue idea, just because they want to avoid this starvation scenario. And that's deliberately making a compromise that they're going to be less good at approximating that SRTF ideal of lowering the mean turnaround time because they think this starvation thing is really bad. Other questions, comments? Okay, so talked about this, feedback queuing idea for minimizing turnaround time. I'm going to talk about another scheduler, which is the Linux scheduler, the default Linux scheduler. Linux supports multiple schedulers. I'm going to talk about the core of the default Linux scheduler. We're not going to talk about a bunch of actually very important details for time, like how it deals with multiple cores or things like that. But the default scheduler is very interesting in that it has a pretty simple design idea at its core. There's a lot of extra details. That is a proportional share scheduler. So it's like our lottery scheduler. If you can set a program as twice as important, it runs twice as much. It does it without random choices, so we don't have that variance issue. And it does it in a way which, in some sense, favors interactive programs. So it has some of the attributes we liked about SRTF or feedback queues, But without going all the way to having that sort of priority-based scheme. And the key idea that the Linux Completely Fair Scheduler is built around is something called virtual runtime. And basically what Linux does is it tracks how long the thread has ran. So every time we run a thread, we increment for however long it gets to use the CPU, a virtual runtime that we track in its thread control block in the OS. And our scheduling decision is that we sort the threads by their virtual runtime. We actually use a balanced tree, so we just maintain that as the threads are running, and run the thread with the lowest virtual runtime. Okay, so far it sounds like I'm treating all the threads equally, so we need to add the proportional share part, the idea that we don't have to make every thread as important. So our solutions are when we're adjusting the virtual runtime for a thread, when we're incrementing based on how long it ran, we can multiply that by a factor. So we can say that some threads, if they use a millisecond, that really counts for two. We also are going to make adjustments for threads that were newer, were sleeping. We'll talk about that in a bit. And this is how we're going to be able to favor interactive programs in some senses. And also, it's kind of important to have a way of dealing with new threads where you might, when we think about this, there's a problem here. But let's look at this sort of steady state situation so you can understand, like, why is this idea, you know, why does this lead to sort of a fair schedule that's kind of similar to what our lottery idea did? We'll look at an example where we have A, B, and C, and we're tracking their virtual runtime. So A has run for 0.5 milliseconds in the past, B has run for 1.25, and C has run for 1.4. That's their virtual runtimes. And at every point in time, we're going to run the thread that has the lowest virtual runtime for some amount of time. So in this case, thread A has the lowest virtual runtime, so we run it because it just hasn't run as much yet. And we're going to choose some amount of time to run it for. I'm probably going to just not go into the details of how that works, but as part of this scheduler, they choose the amount of time to run. In this example, I'm just assuming we always choose a millisecond. And so we run A for a millisecond, we update its virtual runtime, and we look again at the virtual runtimes and say, what do we run next? And I say, okay, I'm going to run B next because now it has the lowest, and we run that and increase its virtual runtime. And now, because we've increased A and B's virtual runtime, C gets a chance, and so on. So you can see that if everyone is always runnable and uses the whole quantum, this is actually just round robin, that if A, B, and C can keep using the CPU forever, they just get to keep running. A, then B, then C, then A, then B, then C, and so on. But what's interesting is how this interacts with threads that give up the CPU for a bit and do some IO. So let's look at how that would work. So let's say A, you know, here has the lowest virtual runtime, and it uses the CPU. We try to give it a millisecond, but it only uses half a millisecond. So in that case, we're going to update its virtual runtime. And, well, we're not going to run A because it's not ready to run. It's waiting for some I/O. And then we're going to run B, which now has the lowest virtual runtime. We run B for a millisecond, and when B is done, A is ready again. So now we're going to say, okay, let's look at A. And A has the lowest virtual runtime, so we're going to run it next. So you can see that, you know, because we accounted for how long A actually used the CPU, we kind of gave it this advantage because it wasn't using all of its quantums. That because it generally used less CPU as a result of doing I/O, A actually got this advantage where it gets to run earlier. So we actually kind of for free approximate some of the good parts of that shortest remaining time first idea, that things that have shorter CPU bursts probably end up getting this advantage, especially, you know, after they finish an I/O operation. So in this case, we run A for, say, a millisecond, then we run C, and then if we look at our virtual times, because A has sort of banked up some time by doing I/O, A gets to run sooner than it would in a sort of round-robin idea. So questions about what's going on in this picture? So the question is, what's the context for the starting value? So presumably before time zero, A, B, and C were running, and this is the amount of time they ran for. Does that answer that question? Other questions? So the question is, I thought a shorter virtual runtime gave higher priority. Yes, which is why here, when A has 0.75 milliseconds of virtual runtime, it gets to run. When A is doing I/O, you know, here, so during this time, you know, A did I/O, its virtual runtime didn't change. The only reason we didn't start A at this point in time is that it wasn't ready to run. Does that help explain things about how this is interacting with priorities? And yes, also, yeah, importantly, when A doing I/O doesn't change its virtual runtime. In general, you know, you only get billed your virtual runtime for actually using the CPU. Okay, so this idea that programs can bank up time seems pretty good for these programs that like do a bit of I/O, and then we want to let them use the CPU, you know, kind of using that time that they were waiting for I/O, you know, getting that time back, we should say. But there's kind of a problem with this taken to the extreme. So let's say A, you know, it started doing some I/O and, you know, it's like waiting for a key press and it's been waiting, you know, almost a second. And in the meantime, or a couple seconds probably, in the meantime, B and C have been using the CPU, sort of alternating. And, you know, they're alternating and then A becomes ready. And if we did nothing, A would have this really low virtual runtime. And that would be bad because A would get to keep running. So if, like, A would just get to run for 850 milliseconds until it caught up with B and C. And we could allow that, but this would cause like lots of weirdness with respect to, like, you know, I run a shell, I step away from my computer for an hour, and suddenly my shell has priority over, you know, every other program running on my machine. That's kind of not what we expect. So to avoid that, what we're going to do is kind of limit sort of how much we'll let A, when it becomes ready after I/O, be out of sync with the lowest virtual time of what we just ran. So in this example, we've just arbitrarily decided that we're going to let A get only a millisecond ahead of the next thing we'd otherwise run. And we can see here that, you know, because we let it get ahead, it still gets to run first, but it doesn't have all this time book banked up, so it's not going to get to hog the CPU. But we're still giving it an advantage, and we can control how much for being something that's interactive that comes back from IO. So a question, are there other ways to solve this problem beyond a hard limit? Probably, but it's not. That's not the sort of strategy that Linux has chosen. So the question is, how are these numbers represented in memory? I believe they're like 64-bit integers. How do they handle overflow? I believe they do, and I don't know the details, but they do something about overflow. And that is an annoying implementation detail that I didn't talk about. And question, what happens if a new thread shows up? We use the same solution, that the new thread would naturally have a value of 0 milliseconds. We'll give it, you know, this value, basically. The minimum value we'd be willing to give. So what we do with these newly ready threads is that, you know, its ready virtual time is its prior or, you know, the minimum of a little less than the minimum virtual time of things that are already ready. And we can adjust this slightly. I'm stating this imprecisely. It might be exactly the minimum virtual time or something like that for new threads. But basically, the key idea is that, you know, we don't want to let programs bank up an infinite amount of time, and we don't want to have new threads have banked up an infinite amount of time. So we set it based on, you know, where we are as far as what virtual time are we running now. Questions about... So one thing I didn't mention explicitly was that, I mentioned it was proportional. So the solution for that is that sometimes if we want to make some programs more important than another, we can modify this algorithm to, you know, say that, this program should get twice as much CPU or should get half as much CPU. So I'm going to make each millisecond of CPU it gets cost 2 milliseconds of virtual time, and that will cause it to basically run half as much as it would otherwise. So we can easily add some priority-like notion to this by doing that. Okay, so now that we know how CFS works, and the question is, instead of a lottery, this just chooses the smallest virtual time? Yes. So something that the Linux people felt was important is that the choice is really fast and really consistent. There's not, it's not sort of hard to predict what's going to run next, even though it supports this sort of proportionality and fairness. Other questions? So I have two programs here that I look at. So I have a program A, which uses the CPU for 4 milliseconds, then waits for IO for 2 milliseconds and repeats that. And program B, which uses the CPU for 1 millisecond and waits for 1.5 milliseconds. So if these programs were running alone, we'd expect A to use 4/6 or 2/3 of the CPU, and B to use 1 over 2.5 or 2/5 of the CPU. So my question is, given that, what about how much CPU time would we expect A to get using CFS in this moment? With this design. And yes, so an important observation here is that 2/3 plus 2/5 is in fact not equal to 1, but is in fact greater than 1. So they can't both get that amount. And the question, is the scheduler consistent across Linux distributions given that there are so many versions of Linux? So for a particular version number of the Linux kernel, the default is always the same, though a Linux distribution could change that default. You could have a different configuration. And Linux has a whole bunch of schedulers you can actually like turn on and off at runtime if you wanted to. Okay, I'll give another 10 seconds. Okay, so a plurality have what I think is the best answer, which is that it, most likely B is going to get about 2/5 and A is going to get about 3/5. So how would we figure that out? So what I like to think is that, well, A can't use more than 2/3. So the maximum for A is 2/3. There's no way A can use more than 2/3 because, you know, if it was running alone, it would use that much. And similarly, the maximum for B is 2/5. There's no way it's going to use more than 2/5 because it's running that much. And also, we know that it's going to be the case that A gets to, that if A and B use the CPU all the time, they'd sort of at least get a half of the CPU. So if they were always able to run, you know, sort of naturally what would happen is we'd have half and half. Now, if we look at that, we learn that, well, you know, B, you know, naturally just can't use that much CPU time. So what's going to happen is that B, you know, is going to always have the lower virtual time. And it's always going to have the lower virtual time because, you know, whenever it needs to run, its virtual time is going to be lower, and it's never going to run for long enough to, you know, catch up to A, which can always use more compute time. So essentially always B is going to have the lower virtual time, maybe those, you know, some points in time when they're equal. And this means that, you know, B gets Lower virtual time. So B gets all of its 2/5. And if that happens, then A is going to get 3/5, and 3/5 is less than 2/3. So A should run for about 3/5 of the time. Does that make sense? So what happens here, you know, is that, B is going to have a lower virtual time because it just wants to run less than A. And in that remaining time, A gets to, A doesn't have enough space to run completely, but it's going to get 3/5. So question is, can I explain why at maximum they would each run for half the time? So if they were running if instead of this pattern here, if they were both just always using the CPU, we get a half and half split. But what's going to happen instead of that is that B is going to try to use, we're going to like, to figure out what happens, I'm going to say B gets to use 2/5 of the time, and then we divide up the remaining time with A. And because B is using, wants less time than A, it's going to generally have a lower virtual time. And that's going to be, so the question is, aren't interactive programs favored so B would get more time? So this is what happens, yes. But the reason why is not because B is interactive, but because B wants to use only 2/5 of the compute time. So B is favored because it wants less CPU time overall. So it's nothing to do with, so the answer would be the same if B, like, used CPU for, like, 10 milliseconds and then did I/O for 15 milliseconds. We get the same answer regardless, even though that might seem less interactive. But in the sense that B wants less CPU, that's how it gets favored to run earlier. And that's sort of the key thing that CFS does, is that CFS is trying to divide the CPU time fairly first. So that's how you should think about what's going to actually happen. So let's apply this principle to this example. So remember, what we're going to think about is that, you know, we're going to try to divide the CPU time fairly, and things that want to use, things will get their full CPU if that means that, you know, they would have an equal, they would, you know, not have more than their total fair share of CPU. So the way I want to think about this is, okay, if, you know, our ideal case is that each of these would get to run for the amount of time they want to. But here we have 2/5, 2/5, and 1. And that means that someone has to pay a price. And so C is not going to get to run for its full, you know, 100% of the time. So how much time does it get to run? So that's the way we should start thinking about this. And if we think about having equal virtual time, what we'd expect is that C gets to run for 1/3. Because it gets 1/3, because each thing has equal weight, so it should get about 1/3 of the CPU time overall. You know, assuming A and B, you know, can use the rest of the CPU. Thank you. I'll give another 10 seconds or so. Okay. So I think a plurality of chosen one, I think, is the most sensible answer, is that that each of these programs gets about a third. So why would this happen? Well, each of them wants more than a third of the CPU time. And that's what would happen if we split it up evenly. And because we're counting virtual time, if any of them manages to use more than a third of the CPU time, they'll acquire this sort of, you know, this higher virtual time, and they'll be disadvantaged compared to the other programs. So we'll end up equalizing where everything runs for about a third of the time. So if any program gets more than a third of the time, its virtual time will be, you know, will be higher, which means it will be delayed. So I would estimate that they'd run for about a third of the time, each of them, including N. Questions about how, why, my reasoning for that? And unlike our prior scenario, like, all these programs certainly can have enough work to do that they can fill in a third of the time. With our prior scenario, we didn't have the same kind of answer because some of the programs A was competing with couldn't actually use half the time in the case of having two programs. But here, since they can, we'll have this sort of round robin thing where if one of them gets, uses more time, it will fall behind and the other things will be able to use the remaining time. Okay. Questions about this? So another answer that might be reasonable to think about is you might guess that A gets to run for less time than one third because maybe A doesn't get to start it. Maybe A doesn't get to start its I/O often enough, so it ends up sort of waiting for I/O too long. So, it's possible you could imagine, A would be, because A's I/O gets delayed, A might not be able to use a third of the CPU. So that would be a reason why I wouldn't object to you choosing less than one third. I don't think this scenario is like what I would think of when I'm making an approximation, but I think also, for this reason, I think less than a third is another reasonable answer, but I think about a third is probably the best basic guess for this sort of approximation. So the question is, so the first reasoning that is that two-fifths and two-fifths and one are greater than a third, yeah, that each of these programs alone would want to use more CPU time than their fair share, right? So their fair share is that they should get a third of the CPU time. And since each of them wants to do that, we don't have any leftover to give other programs, so they're going to get a third. Versus this scenario, where each of them wants to use a half, but one of them, after it uses a half of its CPU time, has some leftover to give to A. Does that idea make sense? So a way we can think about this is that this is splitting up the available time. evenly, but if there's leftover time because something can't use all the time, that has to get used somewhere, but also split up fairly. Okay, so I think I'm basically out of time. So we'll review CFS next time, and I will stop on this convenient, what scheduler should I use? We didn't talk about this scheduler this semester for time reasons. Okay. Type questions before I sign off. We'll